Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, as students return to the classroom across the Golden State, we look at the world of education. We'll dig into the past, present, and future of California's master plan for higher education and find out what it means in the 21st century. Later in the show, we'll get the latest on the Rough Fire, which continues to threaten communities and the forest east of Fresno. And we'll talk to musician Lance Canales, who's getting national and international attention for a new project that comes out this week called The Blessing and the Curse. It's a new CD of roots and blues music that celebrates the San Joaquin Valley. Right now, though, we kick off our look at education in Tulare County. As students head back for another year of school, one small district in the valley is on the cutting edge of education. The Lindsay Unified School District has eliminated grades and grade levels. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports school leaders say the scheme has helped transform education.
It's 7:30 on the first day of school, and students at Lindsay High School reconnect with friends and wait for the bell to ring. The roughly 1,000 students are part of just a handful of districts in the country using a system called performance-based grading. The basic idea is that rather than moving students through grade levels as a class, let them finish their coursework at their own speed, regardless of what year they are in school. 17-year-old senior Leif Caesar explains it this way.
I'm a lot stronger in like history, English, science than like my math, for example. So I moved way ahead of the class, or at least ahead of the class in those classes, and then math, I've been more like with the class.
Instead of assigning students a letter grade on an A through F scale, they receive a number marking their progression through a set of benchmarks that note their proficiency in a subject. A 1 is the foundational work, moving up to a 4 being the highest level of skill. If at any point a student earns a 3, they can move on to the next level of coursework regardless of their year or score in other subjects. So, for students like 13-year-old freshman Paola Rusilis, when they are ready to advance, they move on.
That's very helpful for me because at times when I'm mostly good at math but not that great in ELA, so when I'm better at math than some other kids, then I can move ahead to what I need to instead of like being held back.
School leaders say the entire district transitioned to performance-based grading about 7 years ago, after repeated attempts to improve the district failed.
Hey, Victor, what class do you have first?
School Dean of Culture Abby Forbes greets the students on the sunny concrete in the center of the campus overlooked by the Sierra foothills. She says since they instituted performance-based grading, they've seen their graduation rate rise to nearly 90%, and last year sent 40% of their students to four-year colleges.
Basically, we believe that all learners learn in different times in different ways. And if that's the case, then why do we put them all, because they're 15 in the same classroom, and say everyone must be here and then move forward from there?
Forbes says it's incredibly common for students to be at different levels in different subjects or to move up a unit in the middle of the year.
If you want something you've never had, you've got to do something you've never done.
Now an administrator, Jaime Robles was principal of the high school before and during the shift. He says prior to performance-based grading, the school was rife with drugs, violent gangs, and dropouts. Now that the school focuses on each student's strengths and weaknesses, those behavioral problems have been greatly reduced.
And there goes some of the classroom management issues. There goes some of the frustration and boredom. There goes some of the roots for absenteeism. There goes some of the causes for dropout. If you're able to really effectively meet everybody at their level versus asking kids to hold tight while the teacher teaches to the middle.
It's been a transition for the teachers as well. English teacher Brandy Quintero had to totally rethink how she runs her class.
I know that I get to take time to actually teach students to proficiency, but at the same time it's harder because I have to be more prepared. I have to be prepared for the students who are ready to go faster than I'm teaching. I have to be prepared for the students who are taking more time.
But how could simply changing how students are graded generate such dramatic changes both in and out of the classroom? Matt Townsley is an education researcher and administrator at a school in Iowa that uses a system similar to Lindsay's. He says the common model of grading punishes students for practicing, obscures true progress, and limits students. All problems performance-based grading attempts to address. However, he thinks the new system has been slow to catch on because it's such a big change from what adults are used to.
It's also perhaps why our communities, our public, are so used to experiencing school the same way time and time again, because most of them experienced it and were fairly successful through that previous experience.
Townsley estimates that fewer than 100 schools across the nation are using a performance-based system. In Lindsay, school leaders say there's no way they would ever go back. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. For the past 2 weeks and more, the Rough Fire has devastated areas of the Sierra Nevada east of Fresno. The blaze has threatened Hume Lake, Balch Camp, and other communities. It continues to burn today. To give us the latest on the story, we have a guest with us now on the phone, Rough Fire spokesperson for Incident Command, Jeffrey Pruitt. Jeffrey, welcome to our program.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Doing well. What's the latest status on the fire as of this Tuesday morning?
Well, this morning we just got our latest report put out, and today we are at 51,000, just a little over 51,000 acres with 17% containment. And that doesn't sound like a whole lot of containment, but actually that containment is in some very critical areas that in the past week we had very huge concerns about.
Now, you did a lot of work last week, last Thursday, doing backburns in the Hume Lake area. Those have helped the situation a lot there. Is the Hume Lake area, both the camp and the private cabins in that area, is it out of the woods at this point in terms of the risk of the fire to a property in that area, or is that still a concern for fire crews?
You know, it's an ongoing concern. Whenever we get into a battle with Mother Nature and fire, you know, we'd like to feel more comfortable about where we are, and we are making progress, and we are feeling better about the whole situation, but we're still being cautious with this Hume Lake, with the Hume Lake community and the cabins. If our progress keeps moving forward like we're seeing it, we are going to continue to be able to report some good news, and people are going to be able to return to those areas, and the danger will decrease.
You look at some of these fire maps, it's almost like you're looking at a military history text in terms of flanking and outflanking. Is there a concern that the fire might outflank the areas that you've backburned and cut other lines to reduce fuel in the area? Is that the primary concern, at least in that area?
Well, all it takes is a little shift in our wind, because we have no moisture and we have the high temperatures. So where our issue may come into play is if the winds would pick up, winds change. But right now, you know, we have a lot of professionals here, the meteorologists, the fire behavior analysts, who are watching what's going on out here, and so that we can plan ahead if we think that something like that may happen. So as we move through day to day, we're feeling more comfortable that we're getting the situation taken care of here. And we're going to continue to have success. We're going to continue to put this fire out and manage that and protect any life safety issues or property issues that may arise.
What's the biggest challenge in fighting this fire? Is it the terrain? Is it the drought and the dry conditions? What's the one thing that makes this sort of unique?
Well, early on, it was the terrain. We couldn't get any boots on the ground. It was extremely difficult to get fire engines in where we needed to get them in. So the terrain initially was a big issue. As the fire started to burn a little bit further out, we were able to get dozers, get firefighters on the ground, get fire engines in place for structure protection. But that was, you know, the biggest issue in the beginning. And so, you know, safety for not only our fire personnel out there on the line, but also for the community is number one by far. And, you know, we won't risk any lives, unless it's extremely something that we're going to protect that's extremely important, which is the general public's, you know, life. And, you know, that's the terrain and the lack of moisture and the fuels have been the highest concern for us as far as coming to the safety of our personnel.
There's been a lot of talk about the Hume Lake area, a little less about the threat to the PG&E facilities at Balch Camp. But a few days ago, you held a meeting at PG&E's facility, their headquarters for the Courtright-Wishon area. And I thought, why are they holding a meeting all the way over there? That's more on the Shaver Lake side of the mountains. And then I now hear that you have concerns about the fire going towards Wishon. Tell me about the northern side of the fire.
Okay. Yeah, you know, all along, this fire's had two fronts. There's been the Hume Lake front of this fire that's been kind of moving to the east-southeast, and then there's been the other side of the fire that's been moving to the west, the northwest. And so that area out there around the Balch Camp and the PG&E plant has been a concern all along, and we have a total separate incident management team that's assigned to that area up there who's managing that. And so they're very busy doing putting structure protection in place, building fire lines up there so that we can protect that community up there completely. And I know that they're very busy on that end of the fire.
And those people in that area, they are under not a mandatory evacuation at this point, but they've been told to be aware?
That's right. It's all about making sure that everybody is prepared, you know, ready, set, go, making sure that if something does change, that they are prepared to evacuate that area if they would have to. And, you know, we will make sure that as this fire moves that direction, that we keep those folks updated and that they have plenty of time to move if they have to move. But right now, as you said, there's been no mandatory evacuations issued for that area. We're basically just doing a lot of preparation up there right now, clearing away any dead overgrowth, cleaning it up, and doing all types of fire prevention activities up there to prevent any damage to that area that could occur if the fire moved in there.
Just a couple more things on the south side of the fire to go back to the Hume Lake and Grant Grove area. Grant Grove has reopening after a closing over the weekend. Is that area under any threat at this point?
Grant Grove is in pretty good shape. We're feeling very comfortable about that. You know, obviously we would not let the general public back into that area if we did not feel comfortable with our progress there. And so our hope is that each day that goes on, as we work with the Park Service, we start allowing folks to get moved back in and allow those visitors that want to go to that area to be able to access that area, because it is a very beautiful area there. I'm not from California, so I enjoy coming out here and seeing, you know, this beautiful countryside just like the tourist would. And so we're excited about the fact that we think that's going to continue to move forward unless something changes weather-wise, but we're feeling good about it.
Any idea of when you hope fire crews might be able to get this blaze fully contained? Are we looking at months, weeks? Any idea on that?
It's really hard to put a date on this, on getting it completely extinguished. Many fires will continue to burn for quite some time. You know, our main concern right now is areas where there are life and property at risk, and we will address those concerns first. And then as the fire burns into unpopulated areas where we don't have those threats of life and property, you know, this could go on until there's a significant amount of moisture that falls here in California, because really that is the answer to most of these fires throughout out the West, is we just need rain, and we don't have that right at the moment. So hopefully that will eventually come. But there's no date we can really pin on this thing to say this is the day it's going to go out when we think it'll be out.
Again, we've been talking with Jeffrey Pruitt, Rough Fire spokesman for Incident Command, talking about the blaze, which has now consumed over 51,700 acres, 17% contained. Jeffrey, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is Valley Edition. The Rough Fire is not only causing problems for the Hume Lake camp and other facilities in the area. When Highway 180 closed, it also stranded a number of people in the backcountry. Last week, Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero caught up with some of those people.
25 hikers finally made it out of the backcountry of the Sierra Nevada after being trapped at Road's End in Kings Canyon National Park for up to 2 days.
How'd you guys get here?
We hiked out. We got up at 5 o'clock this morning, and we hiked up a 5.5-mile, 3,500-foot hike. So we are dead.
Backpacker Don Dufer came off of his first 40-mile trek in the Sierra Nevada to find that he couldn't return to Santa Cruz when he wanted to.
I was pretty delirious when I got to the Road's End, and EMTs were right there, and they put me on oxygen and everything because I couldn't breathe. 45 minutes worth of oxygen did me good.
The hikers were put up at Cedar Grove Lodge, where they showered, ate, and slept. Many of the hikers had to leave their cars at Road End before their trek out of the park. Richard and Patsy Hughes from San Diego were on a 5-day cross-country excursion. They didn't even know there was a fire burning.
And our campsite on the fifth day, at almost 12,000 feet, was engulfed in smoke. We knew it was coming from the west of us, but we didn't know where the fire really was.
The backpackers say they're relieved to finally stop hiking, but say there are others still out in the backcountry. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And Ezra joins us in the studio now to tell us a little more about the situation there. Last week, Thursday, was a big day for the fire. You were there at Hume Lake. In fact, you were one of the last reporters there on Hume Lake on Thursday. What exactly was the scene there at that time? You've got a lot of firefighters.
I got there really early in the morning to do some reporting, and they ended up letting me through the gate, and when I came down the hill, there's firefighters starting to like prepare the roads for burning. And then once you get down to, or like burning to like clear the road so fire trucks can come in and out when the fire starts, if it reaches there, to create like a safety line in some sense. And then when you got down to Hume Lake Christian Camp, it was sort of eerie. Firefighters hanging out everywhere, very, very smoky. You can't see across the lake, can barely see across the street, and there's ash falling. My car still smells like smoke today, 5 days later.
And I understand that you were there, you were working on interviewing crews, and then they asked you to leave because those backburn operations were going to take place along those roads.
Yeah, they were like, you're safe here, but if you don't leave now, you won't be able to leave till tomorrow because we're going to be burning both highways in and out of Hume Lake's camp, and so you wouldn't be able to leave because there'd be fire coming from every direction, essentially.
Now, certainly the fire has advanced since Thursday when you were there on scene. But what was the drive in like? Did you see a lot of burned areas on Highway 180? And
I actually didn't see anything burned. There was nothing burned all the way down to the camp. I think it's a bit east of there on Highway 180.
Yeah, and that was when the fire was still approaching the Hume Lake Dam from the north, from the northeast, I guess. Mm-hmm. And eventually those backburn operations proved to save
the camp,
at least for the time being. And what was the mood like in terms of talking with people there at the time, and both there and also at Grant Grove?
Well, down at Hume Lake, they were pretty optimistic, even though it felt so smoky. And I felt like, as a journalist coming in, that this place might burn down or something, because it just felt like you were like a volcano was exploding or something. But up at Grant's Grove, where I was there later in the day, the mood was a bit different. There were a lot more tourists, and people were wondering what the heck's going on. What's that big pillar of smoke, plume of smoke going on? So there were a lot of questions and not a lot of optimism there.
Ezra David Romero joining us today to talk about his experience reporting on the Rough Fire for Valley Public Radio. Ezra, thank you. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on Valley Edition and find out more about higher education in the Valley and also the story about One Valley Immigrant Group and their efforts to preserve their heritage. Listening to Valley Edition. The Central Valley is home to many diverse communities. In fact, it's the entire history of this part of the state. Groups from across the world have come here searching for a better life and new opportunities. One recent immigrant group is facing a challenge that many others before them have faced, raising the first generation of offspring born here in the Valley. As FM 89's Deanna Aguilera reports, with this comes the struggle of preserving a cultural identity while embracing growing up in the States.
At Danielle Awalma's house in Clovis, her living room is covered with traditional African drums and exotic masks.
These are the two masks that we have, and this one too. They represent different spirits.
She's really into it, but
that much I'm not really like in. Like, I know more about, but I know that each mask is significant to a specific spirit.
She doesn't know much about it because she grew up in America. The masks belong to her parents who were born and raised in Nigeria. They're part of the Igbo community, mostly from the southern part of the country. Awalma came to the States when she was 4 months old. And as a teenager, she wanted to fit in more with the American culture. But now things have changed.
I wish I had grown up there so that I would learn more about my culture, but I only know a little bit here and there about it.
Out of fear of losing her connection to her family's homeland, Awalma and a dozen others created a group just for young Nigerian Igbos.
On behalf of the Igbo Youth Association of Central California, I welcome all of you to our first and historic event, Igbo Youth Day.
Wearing a long black, red, and yellow dress made out of ankara, a popular African fabric, she says a few words to the crowd. It's the first event held by young Igbo teens living in the Central Valley. David Amadi is one of them.
We just made it a point to, you know, make this youth event and group so we don't lose that culture. We want to, you know, keep the culture and the identity that our parents have when they came to America.
The group of 12 all wore colorful outfits made out of the African fabric. Standing in front of their peers and parents, they performed a dance called Igbo Amaka, which means Igbo is beautiful. It's estimated that around 300 Igbo families live in the Central Valley. Most of the parents that migrated to this area came within the last 15 to 40 years to pursue a higher education or for work. Henry Aputa is one of them.
Many of us have been in the Central Valley sharing our culture and heritage individually and collectively. But this is the first time that our children are expressing the same interest.
He says it's now up to the younger generation to continue their presence in the valley.
Our children are the only one that can truly carry on our heritage, our culture, our history.
The Igbo people are one of the largest single ethnic groups in Africa, and they're one of the three major Nigerian tribes. Many of the older generation that settled in America lived through the Nigerian Civil War as children back in the late 1960s. Shauna Redmond, a USC ethnicity professor, says the idea of creating a youth group among Igbo teens helps expand the immigrant narrative.
I think it's particularly interesting that this is happening amongst a group of African-descended young people because, particularly in California, we don't often think about the immigrant story as being from the continent of Africa.
21-year-old Danielle Awalma says during her high school years, most people labeled her a certain way.
Just by plain sight, they're just like, oh, okay, you're black. You know, they don't really bother to be like, oh, you're Nigerian? That's really cool. So, like, can you tell me about Nigeria and your culture? It's just like, oh, okay, you know.
And that's one of the reasons why she joined the youth group, so she could share stories with other young Nigerian Igbos. It's a place where they can openly talk about their experiences as second-generation immigrants, including challenges some may face.
Basically, because we're like second generation, our parents are pushing us more for education and making sure that you go all the way in whatever degree that you're pursuing. And then from there, that's when you can decide to have kids, get married, things of that nature.
It's been 3 months since they created the Young Igbo Group. They hope to host more events throughout the Central Valley and encourage more teens to join. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Diana Aguilera.
The falling price and exploding popularity of consumer drones are causing growing concern about safety in the air. Earlier this month, a Life Flight helicopter in Fresno nearly collided with the drone. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports rogue drone operators are becoming a nuisance, invading sensitive private airspace, and regulators are nearly powerless to stop them.
In a dusty field in central Fresno, wedding photographer and hobby drone enthusiast Chris Geiger fires up the electric motors on his small four-propeller helicopter. The two-foot-wide black-and-white drone leaps into the air and hovers for a moment, perfectly steady. Geiger sends the drone, which he prefers to call an unmanned aerial system, or UAS, shooting into the sky to demonstrate how easy it would be for the drone to reach 1,000 feet or more.
300, 350, 400 feet.
Geiger pans the helicopter's onboard camera and watches the video on a cell phone mounted on the drone's remote control.
Most people with the helicopters like this model are using them to experiment and play around with the aerial view.
While Geiger's drone costs several thousand dollars, he says even a much cheaper model could fly beyond 1,000 feet or more with ease. The 1,000-foot mark is important because that is the level where emergency service helicopters and wildfire-fighting planes fly. Recently, a drone flying near the Fresno-Yosemite International Airport nearly collided with a Life Flight helicopter. Vince Ellis was the EMT on that flight. He says he's never seen a helicopter have to dodge a drone before.
I think we'll really be beefing up our drone awareness. And I think that this, fortunately, this situation has heightened our awareness of what's going on around us, so we'll definitely be on the lookout for them more often.
Ellis also points out many emergency response helicopters fly unpredictable patterns, increasing the risk of a drone collision. Drone sales are taking off. An industry group expects more than 700,000 drones to be sold this year, which is a 63% increase over 2014. Matthew Raymond, the president of Fresno Radio Modelers, says reckless operators are giving drones a bad name.
There's a lot of good uses for these platforms, but when the average person gets a hold of them that's uneducated on how they should fly them or the dangers, it really puts a black eye on the whole hobby.
Raymond says it's impossible to know how many drones are in the valley, but he estimates the number is in the tens of thousands. At the same time, his club has just 160 members. The drones, according to some, are the new laser pointer when it comes to direct threats to pilots and their crew. Todd Valeri with American Ambulance, the company that runs the Valley's Life Flight service, says new regulations are necessary to protect crews.
As there are more incidents, you will see more of an effort to implement regulation, but that'll only take us so far. Certainly there are regulations against flashing laser devices at aircraft, but we do see that, and that's, while it's not common, it's not exactly rare either.
The FAA has regulations that limit how high or close to an airport the drones can fly. But those rules are widely flaunted, and catching the pilot of a drone is nearly impossible unless a law enforcement officer sees it land. Stanton Floria with the U.S. Forest Service says drones have interrupted numerous firefighting missions by flying too close to wildfires. He says they anticipated the problem with drones and prepared a campaign called "If You Fly, We Can't."
Our national interagency fire partners were aware that the drone sales last holiday season had really skyrocketed. So we're seeing more incursions of hobby drones on wildfires in California this season.
Floria says they're working with law enforcement to catch people operating drones illegally, but concedes it's a challenge. The increasing run-ins with drones has caught the attention of the state legislature. First District State Senator Ted Gaines has filed two bills, one to increase the penalties for flying near fire zones, and another to allow emergency responders to take the drones out of the sky.
It's gotten just ahead of us, and we need to take action and do so, in my view, as quickly as possible so that we're educating people, they know what the rules are, and if they violate, that there's a consequence.
And other than just flying for fun, drones could have practical uses in actually helping emergency responders. The wedding photographer Chris Geiger was recently asked by a fire department to fly into a burned-out building to check its structural integrity. And the Forest Service is looking for ways to use drones to monitor fires in difficult or dangerous-to-reach places. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. Summer is winding down, and kids across the valley are back in the classroom. Classes began today for students at Fresno State, while the fall quarter at CSU Bakersfield begins in a few weeks. Students there and throughout California's public university system might not know it, but their schooling is guided by the state's master plan for higher education. It was drafted in 1960 and formally lays out the state's original goal for the system to provide top-notch higher education that's available for all students regardless of financial status. In this piece from NPR member station KALW of San Francisco, reporter Jen Chien catches us up with what's in that master plan and what it means for students today.
Have you heard of the California Master Plan for Higher Education of 1960?
No, I have not.
No, I have not.
I've never heard of it before.
No, I haven't.
No.
No, you haven't.
I have not.
No, not really.
Of 1960? No, I'm not aware of that. And no.
Yes, actually. I heard about it in my ethnic studies class. I would have had no idea. I don't think anyone really knows about it. Which is weird because it's supposed to be like the master plan. I feel like everyone should know. But I don't think people really know that like there is a plan in California for everyone to go to college.
That was an unscientific sample I took of students at San Francisco State University. That last guy, Mazen Magoob, had it right. California really does have a plan for everyone to go to college. In the early 60s, the state's future looked sunny and bright. Pat Brown, father of our current governor, Jerry Brown, was in his first term as governor, and he had an ambitious agenda.
I think the state of California is the greatest place in all God's earth. We're making it better in every way.
That clip is from the 2011 documentary, A California State of Mind. Governor Pat Brown oversaw the creation of much of what defines California today. Landmark civil rights legislation, massive freeway expansion, and the design and construction of the state's complex water system. Brown also presided over the creation of the master plan, the blueprint for the state's college system. Baby boomers were coming of age, and that meant a flood of new students in higher education. And in the spirit of the big projects of the day, Governor Brown wanted a more coherent plan for the state's system of higher education, a kind of sweeping statement of principles and goals. He convened 15 education advisors to draft it. Clark Kerr, who was president of UC at the time, was the plan's main architect.
The university is being called upon to educate previously unimagined numbers of students, to respond to the expanding claims of national service, to merge its activities with industry as never before.
The state already had a public college system, but the new plan tried to better define each school's role. The UCs were supposed to focus on research, the CSUs on preparing teachers, and the community colleges on preparing students for transfer to the four-year schools. In this way, every high school graduate was guaranteed entry into the system. And although students would be expected to pay for incidentals like dorm housing or textbooks, tuition was supposed to be free.
So far as the governor can stop it, there will never be a tuition at the University of California or the state colleges or the junior colleges of our land. Believe me.
I'm Beverly Hayon. I'm 67 years old, and I live in San Francisco. Simply put, I had a public education from beginning to end.
Beverly Hayon's path through school followed the plan. Beginning as a child, she went to Los Angeles public schools, then to Los Angeles City College.
And from there transferred to San Francisco, where I actually attended for one semester San Francisco City College and then went on to San Francisco State. And I graduated in 1968.
Her tuition wasn't free, though it was very low. See, the master plan itself was never a law. It was a set of recommendations for legislators to act on. And as it turned out, free tuition was one of many recommendations that never became law. Some others were consistent admission standards across the three systems, increases in funding, and a proposed full-year calendar that included adult education. Still, the plan seemed to work, especially for students like Hayon. She says she always wanted to go to college, but that when she graduated high school, she didn't really know how to get there.
I'm the daughter of an immigrant. My mother did not really understand or know how to manipulate the public school system. So I never had any encouragement or guidance or help in planning for college.
Given that lack of support, She says that the accessibility of community college was key to her success.
Because no planning was involved, I didn't have to think about it or apply. You know, you just went to City College and signed up for your classes whenever, you know, registration was in progress.
Heian worked all through school.
I was actually a long-distance operator back in the day when you actually had all these cords that you had to plug into little holes. And so that's a really long time ago.
Even while working, she says she never felt like a degree was out of her reach.
I think the system worked very well for me.
When Heian was at SF State, student fees were around $50 a semester. Students today pay much more. Adenike Hamilton was president of the Student Association at SF State for the 2012-13 academic year. I spoke with her at her office in the Student Union building.
Now tuition is way over $3,000 a semester, and that's just for registration and fees. That doesn't include books or housing or things like that that are also student necessities.
Even adjusted for inflation, that's more than five times as much as Heian paid. And tuition has risen sharply at all three branches of the state's higher education system, especially in the last decade. Just like when the boomers were coming of age, California's college-age population is growing. The number of high school graduates hit an all-time high in 2010. But with more and more cut from their budgets each year, the UCs and CSUs are accepting fewer and fewer of their in-state applicants. So, Hamilton says, class availability and overcrowding are also major issues.
At the beginning of the semester, there's a huge rush for students who weren't able to add the class during the registration periods, trying to crash classes. You see people sitting on the floors trying to get into the classes, things like that.
This competition to get into the classes that you need, plus the rising cost of tuition, can make going to a California public university a stressful experience.
You know, what's the quality of education when you're taking seven classes because you can't, you know, you're trying to take as many as possible to get out of here? Or what's the quality of education when, you know, you are not able to take the classes that you need and you end up taking filler classes that you don't need and you're not working towards, well, you're working towards a degree, but it's not in the way that, you know, you want to get there.
Hamilton's statement could also be about the system as a whole. California is working toward college degrees for its students, but how are we getting there? Robert Shireman of education policy think tank California Competes says it's no wonder the plan is faltering under the weight of so many changes.
Really, the plan was only supposed to be a plan for 1960 to 1975.
The idea was that a higher education oversight board would revisit the master plan every 5 to 10 years to check in with how the state was doing. But there really haven't been any major changes to the plan in these 50-plus years. And in fact, Governor Jerry Brown closed down the oversight board in 2011.
And so we have kind of been drifting, operating on the fumes of the master plan without really revising it to acknowledge the changed world that we live in and the very different California that we are in.
Shireman says there were many things that the people who wrote the plan could not have predicted. For example, shifting gender roles.
When the plan was drafted, most women did not go to college. So when they were figuring out their projections of how many people will need to be housed in our colleges and universities around the state, they were making those projections based on what they saw in the world then.
In other words, only men. And the state's demographics have changed a lot in the last 50 years, much of that due to immigration. We now have more than 1.5 million English language learners in the school system, a fact which the master plan takes no account of. At the time of the master plan's writing, it was still possible to make a decent living with just a high school diploma. But today,
the labor market has changed now, where you pretty much need to have some type of college education in order to get a good family-sustaining job.
And then there's the decline in state spending on higher education. When Beverly Heian graduated in 1968, California was spending about 17% of its budget on its world-class university system. 40 years later, that number is more like 11%.
If you go back to the 50s and the 60s, when the master plan was in its heyday, we had a lot of money, and the state was doing really well.
Michael Kirst is a professor emeritus at Stanford and president of the California Board of Education.
So you've got a master plan for a period when you had a lot more money per pupil and in willingness to spend it on public services than we do now.
Kirst says the master plan was born out of an era when there was just a lot more confidence in the idea of planning.
Now you don't hear much about master planning in America for much of anything. We're much more of a freewheeling. Things happen bottom up. Our area, the Silicon Valley, is very much, you can't plan Silicon Valley. It just morphs from thing to thing. So the whole idea that you can build a master plan for an animal as complex as California post-secondary education doesn't seem to fit with the times anymore.
He says maybe we don't even need a document like the master plan anymore.
For its own time, the master plan was bold, creative, and innovative. And so what I keep thinking about is this the time for California once again to think of an entirely new model?
And the architects of that new model may just come from the ranks of students currently enrolled in California's public universities. Someone like Mazen Magoob, who learned about the master plan in his class at SF State.
Do you feel like it would be important for your peers, for other students to know about that?
Not just my peers, but I think they should teach it in high school, like when people are applying to college, so that they know that like their state has made them a promise that they should get a higher education.
A promise that California is still figuring out how to keep. In San Francisco, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. From musical roots in the Delta blues to folk artists and more, Lance Canales captures the sound of Americana on his new CD called The Blessing and the Curse. It's his first for a major label. It comes out on Friday on Music Road Records. He joins us in our studio today to talk about the release and an upcoming concert in Fresno that celebrates the occasion. Lance, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you, and thanks for having me. And it's good to see you, Joe.
Yeah. I want to ask you, your music is really interesting because it combines a lot of different influences, yet it sounds very cohesive. It's mm-hmm. not just a disparate parts coming together. Mm-hmm. You do have that Mississippi Delta blues thing right. going on yeah. through so much of it, though. How did that develop? How did somebody from Fresno get influenced and bring that into their music the way you did?
Well, I mean, you know, when it comes to Delta blues, yeah, it's just something that I felt, and this is the honest truth. When I was a little kid, I was trying to find this. I needed to find this particular guitar sound, and I tried. I honestly listened to. I would ask him questions. How do you, I want to hear. And I was like, there was something that I needed to hear, and it was blues. Until I found like people like Robert Johnson and people like Sun House, those old players from the 30s and the 40s and even beyond that, earlier than that, when I found them, that's when I realized that's the music I've been trying to find all my life. And so, That's the kind of style I want to base my career on, and I don't necessarily play exactly like they do, but it's influenced. And I said, okay, they played that style. How can I play something that's a little bit different, and maybe my own version of it? And maybe it could be new, or maybe sound a little bit old, but still be current. You know what I mean? That's kind of my thing. And I'm trying to create my own sound in my own way. Because, you know, as an artist, you don't paint the Mona Lisa again. You know, it's been done already. You don't paint something that looks like Jackson Pollock. You know, you do your own. You do your own painting. You do your own style. You mix your own colors. You do your own mediums. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to take from a style that I love so much and just create something, you know, a little bit different, a little bit new, but still has that old spirit in it.
A lot of your music is heavily influenced by the San Joaquin Valley,
yeah.
Musically, in terms of the sound, in terms of the lyrics. Tell me a little bit how you think that plays out in this record.
It has the title of the record, The Blessing and the Curse, is very much a San Joaquin Valley thing. You know, the San Joaquin Valley is a harsh place, but it's also, you know, agriculture and it feeds the world, you know. From California A Bus to a song called Weary Feet Blues, where I sing, it's basically in first person, this man who jumps over the fence and he crosses the Sonora Desert trying to come and, you know, find work here in the Central Valley. His destination is the San Joaquin Valley. And the chorus line is, if the desert don't get me, La Migra man sure will. And so it kind of make the immigration officer the boogeyman. And then there's Fruit Basket, you know, singing about the San Joaquin Valley and the way things are in Fresno, you know, the homeless and the things that we have and trying not so much just stuffing things down people's throats, but kind of using poetry. You know, trying to use poetry. I'm not, you know, consider myself a poet, but, create a sound that somebody is going to go, oh, that's kind of cool. And at the same time, I'm saying something worthwhile. You know, that's a really hard thing to do, and I'm trying my best to do it. Otherwise, I'm just beating people over the head, and no one wants to hear that.
So go ahead and listen to Fruit Basket now. Again, it's a track from this new CD, The Blessing and the Curse. It comes out Friday on CD and digital download by Lance Canales. We're on FM 89.
Got a stead boy blind, early kid, choking smog in the fruit basket of the world. Said the goddess is dead, but we're blind, early kid. Smog in the fruit basket of the world.
That was the song Fruit Basket from the new CD, The Blessing and the Curse, by Lance Canales. The CD is released or due to be released on Friday by Music Road Records. It has a number of tunes, original pieces by Lance and inspired by the San Joaquin Valley. One of the pieces that you didn't write, one of the songs you didn't compose is a Woody Guthrie one,
right.
But you really gave it your own spin. It's called Deportee,
yeah.
And we've shared it with our audience before, mm-hmm. Back a couple of years ago, and local poet Tim Z. Hernandez,
yeah,
did so much great work to uncover the story and the names of those Mexican immigrants who were killed in a plane crash in western Fresno County back, I guess, in the late 1940s.
1948, January 28th, 1948.
What was it like covering a Woody Guthrie song? It was pretty significant, pretty well known.
Bruce
Springsteen
well
and everybody yeah, done their version of it.
The most popular ones, yeah.
What was it like covering that, making it your own, and then how was it like putting that out there, and how was it received?
Okay, so covering a Woody Guthrie song, if you're singing This Land Is Your Land, that's the one of the most famous of all famous. It's one of the most famous songs, period. But if you're doing Deportee, that's a whole nother thing, because it was a poem by Woody that became a song by Martin Hoffman, and then picked up by Pete Seeger and just everybody else. I mean, from Johnny Cash to Bob Dylan to Sweet Honey on the Rocks, just a whole bunch of famous and non-famous. Annie DeFranco. I mean, this goes on and on. So, doing this song, I was like, okay. If the deportee victims of the crash hadn't been from crashed here, and they wouldn't have been buried in Holy Cross Cemetery, and the story would have unfolded differently, I might not have done the song, because everybody's done it, you know. I'm kind of one of those guys that I want to find a song that's not everybody's done, and then I want to put my own spin on it, and I want to make it my own, and then I want to celebrate the song that really wasn't that popular that deserves to be popular. But obviously we can't change time, and I did Deportee, and I did it different for the sole purpose of it needed a sense of urgency. It needed to be a little bit angry and a little bit way, way sad, and it needed to be tragic and haunting. And I felt like the old versions, I couldn't sing it like that. There's no way I could sing it like that, because I'm from that community of people who have been discriminated on. My grandfather, my father, and you know, I am of Mexican descent, and I feel like, you know, I need to sing it different. And then the second part of your question, if I haven't forgot it already, presenting it and playing it. That was nerve wracking because it's so different. You know, I literally talked to Nora Guthrie right after the first time me and Tim Hernandez played it in front of him. The first time ever performing it in front of an audience was playing it in front of Nora Guthrie, and I didn't look at the audience. I did not want to see her in the crowd, because I mean, that's Nora Guthrie, you know, and I'm singing one of her dad's songs, and that's a serious song, and to change it like that, it might not have been a good thing, but I had to do it because, you know, it was something I felt very passionate about. And she came into us crying, you know, just crying. And the fact that the names were in the song just made the whole different, you know, made that much different and made it that much more powerful. And then, you know, talking to Arlo last year we played at the Woody Guthrie Folk Festival, and I got to sit with Arlo, and he was just, you know, he just said, I really love your version. It's a great version, and I really appreciate that you did it the way you did. And like Joel Raphael, who is a big inspiration to me, big help to me, he said, that's your version. It's changed the way people are going to sing Deportee. And I was like, oh, man, you know, I was like, that you can't help but just feel. It was just awesome. Anybody else can get mad at me. I don't care. You know what I mean?
That's good validation.
Yeah, that's like getting validation from the man himself. So
let's listen to it now. That's Deportee, Lance Canales performing from his new CD, The Blessing and the Curse.
My father's own father, the way to that river. They took all the money he made in his life. My brothers and sisters come work in the fruit tree. They rode the big truck till they took down and died. We died in your hills, we died in your desert. We died in your valleys, we died in your plains. We died beneath your trees, we died in your bushes. Both sides of the river, we died just the same. Goodbye to my wine, goodbye, Lord's leader. Adios, mi amigos, Jesús y María. We won't have a name, we'd rather be their blame. All we will call us is the Deportee.
Lance Canales is with us. We just heard a section of the song Deportee, a Woody Guthrie classic, reimagined with a new urgency and edge by our guest Lance Canales. His CD is released Friday nationwide. You have a show Saturday in Fresno to celebrate it.
Yeah.
Tell us about this, and how important is this for you to share it with your hometown?
Well, it's very, very important to me, because everything I do is basically trying to shed light in a really, you know, I just saw a couple of weeks ago or last week, it was, you know, Fresno is one of the poorest cities. And I was like, oh, well, you know, we don't need to be told that, you know, we already know that it's harsh. You know, we already know it's hot out there and there's a lot of work to do and blah, 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 you know, but it's for me, it's very important because this is where I grew up. This is where I'm from. I'm from a Rosi. I'm the little Rosi boy. You know what I mean? I'm a foreign town boy. You know, I grew up on the back of a horse. And to go from a horse to Austin, Texas to record this album and to have my music played all over Europe right now, it's in all over the country, and singing about our home, you know, why, what better way to do is just to celebrate all ages show at Arte Americas on the, August 29th. The album is out on August 28th, so it's the very next day. I want everybody to show up, man.
That's great. Again, Lance Canales, the CD is called The Blessing and the Curse. Your website, Lance?
LanceCanalesandtheFlood.com.
We wish you the best in this new project. Again, The Blessing and the Curse on Music Road Records. It's released Friday nationwide. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, man.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet at KVPR and at Valley Edition on Twitter. You can also find our audio archives on the web at kvpr.org. Click on the Valley Edition link, and you can also find individual stories on our website as well, which has been newly redesigned, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Deanna Aguilera and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. We hope you'll join us again next week for another Valley Edition here on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.